This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last week, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus announced that its traveling elephants would be retired from performing in 3 years by 2018. The executive vice president, Alana Feld, acknowledged that there's been a mood shift among the public and a lot of people aren't comfortable with us touring with our elephants. Animal rights and conservation groups have been protesting the treatment of circus elephants for years and filing lawsuits. Circuses have also faced local ordinances banning elephants in their shows. We asked Susan Nance to join us on Radio Times. She's the author of a book called Entertaining Elephants. She's an associate professor in the Department of History and affiliated faculty with the Campbell Center for the Study of Animal Welfare that's at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. And Susan Nance, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Did Ringling Brothers make the right decision?
Yes. Yes, I think they did. Absolutely. I think this is going to make their business logistically a lot less complicated and probably more profitable. And I think they're going to reinvent themselves and stay relevant for many years to come now.
They acknowledged a kind of a mood shift among the public. How do you see that mood shift?
Well, I think they're absolutely right about that, and I thought it was very brave for them to finally admit that publicly, because I know that they've been aware of it for some time. I'm sure of it, and I think they're absolutely right. I think, you know, there was a big shift. It was probably a couple of generations in the making, but, you know, starting in the 60s and 70s and into the 1980s, people started to be able to see, you know, wildlife documentaries in color on television in the house that showed elephants doing elephant things at large in Asia and Africa. And I think that that started to change people's minds about what an elephant was and what the proper uses of an elephant were. And so by the time we get to sort of the last 10 or 15 years, you know, most of the people taking or going to a Ringling show, it tends to be parents with young kids. And for most of them, that's always been kind of the norm, that elephants are these sort of wild animals rather than a captive animal. And I think the protests have become so common and been going on for 20 years now with some regularity. You know, for those parents, that's the norm, that there's people protesting at the circus or that it's controversial because of the elephants. So the demographic is just changing, I think, because there's just new people going to the circus now.
There's also been some fascinating research about elephant societies, about the family bond, the family relationship. I actually posted something on our Facebook page yesterday about a mother and father elephant helping their baby at a zoo who had sort of tumbled off a wall and needed their assistance to sort of get upright. And I mean, to be honest with you, it's a very moving video. But we know so much more about these animals.
Well, I think we do, and I think the difference is that the public knows so much more about them. And it's true, there's been a lot of scientific research that has just sort of verified these things. But, you know, the thing that I found interesting when I was doing my research is that, you know, the scientists now are really just verifying things that a lot of people had known for centuries about elephants, or suspected, or, you know, there's this kind of folk wisdom about they had mysterious ways of communicating and that they had long memories and would hold grudges, and, you know, and that they the social relations were very, very important to them, that they were kind of very family oriented and also political. So you're absolutely right about this new research, and I think when the public sees that, they think, okay, well, you know, now I know a broader range of what elephants choose to do when they're left to their own devices and what they're capable of. And so I think, especially since they're also endangered now and threatened in many parts of the world, you know, the circus elephant as a performer seems like an unsympathetic portrayal, I think.
Elephants, I can't imagine what it costs to take care of an elephant in a circus, not just sort of traveling them around, their care, their feeding. Do you think in part this was a financial decision on the part of Ringling Brothers?
I think it was mostly a financial decision, I suspect. Yeah, I believe so. I mean, there's many forms of entertainment and other kinds of activity that are very, very profitable and also controversial, right? And people often, the businesses that have a controversial form of entertainment can often use the controversy and sort of turn it to their own advantage, you know. But in this case, I think that just, you know, I've heard numbers bandied about of, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 per elephant per year.
Wow.
And that is a lot of money to invest in an act, or multiply that times six and then the elephants you have in the winter quarters as well, you know, multiply that by many times, and that's a huge chunk of the profit that gets taken up. And I suspect that inside Ringling, because I know in circuses they make these kind of decisions all the time, you know, is this particular act earning more than it's costing us, or does it have, you know, some role in the show that is so crucial that we will keep it on no matter what? And the way circuses work is that there's a variety of acts all put together in one show, so they're very flexible. And circus companies have for decades and decades, if they find that one act isn't working anymore, or they choose to remove it, they just, you know, pull it out and put something else in and kind of rearrange things, and they can keep going.
One of the things that I found that in your book really fascinating is that elephants either don't breed if they are in the circus or rarely breed. What does that tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that the population in the circus, the captive population, is not self-sustaining. I think it's more complicated simply than that, you know, elephants aren't happy.
I was wondering about that.
Many people take it to indicate that, you know, that they're, for whatever reason, they're not, they're just not in a sort of like a social organization of their own making that would allow for the proper kind of relations that would allow males and females to mate. And so I think, you know, that people have tried this in the zoos for a very long time and in the circuses, and I know that recently they've sort of overcome this problem by using artificial insemination. So at the Ringling Brothers Center for Elephant Conservation down in Florida, they have quite a number of babies down there, and there's also African Lion Safari, which is near Hamilton, Ontario, where they have a big herd of elephants and a successful breeding program there. And I think what people have found is that if you put elephants in the right kind of stationary facility, and maybe there's some artificial insemination at work as well, it's possible to breed baby elephants, and people are getting better at keeping those elephants alive longer, and allowing, I think, the elephants themselves to do more of the labor of caring for the babies, which is how you get healthy young elephants. But on a circus show, there's no way, because you're moving all the time. The elephants have to be contained and chained up, or, you know, put in an electrified paddock, or just their movements have to be restricted and controlled all the time, so they don't get loose. And there's just no way for elephants to have the kind of social relations they need to breed.
You mentioned the word happy. I mean, you know, when we're talking about an animal like an elephant, it's sort of hard to use words like that. But nonetheless, you also mentioned the fact that elephants have to be chained up. These are wild animals. And we know from reports and studies and pictures and videos of some of the mistreatment of elephants to get them to do, you know, the kinds of tricks that people go to the circus to see.
Yeah, and so happy. Yeah, I know happy is kind of a funny word for me to use, isn't it?
It is a funny word. I know,
but that's how I think about it. You know, and what I mean by that is just, you know, elephants have, there's certain kinds of, and all species have this, including us. You know, they have certain kinds of activities and needs, things that they're wired for, and you can't train it out of an elephant. You know, they're designed to rove around and eat and browse all day, every day, and just always looking for food. And so that means they're just always kind of restless and hungry and want to move. So to be forced to sort of stand still in one spot because we got to get on this train, or we have to get in the van, we got to drive to the next city, you know, it's hard work for them. And I think what a lot of the research is showing now is that this is that hard work suppresses elephants' immune system sometimes. It can make them harder to manage because they get frustrated. They develop behavioral problems, you know, effectively. And so a happy elephant is an elephant that, you know, is most of the time able to practice those sort of species-typical behaviors and do what they have that urge to do.
Do they want to sit on a chair, stand on their heads? I mean, this is often what they've been asked to do in the circus.
Yeah, probably, well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think for older adult elephants, no. And I think that this is something that I know Ringling Brothers has been doing this, you know, that you don't put every elephant on the show. You find the ones that are amenable to the training and can handle the traveling, and you use them on the show. And the older ones that are more likely to be asserting their independence or who have become slow or just not a sort of performance ready, you know, you leave them in the conservation center. But juvenile elephants, I mean, this is how, you know, Americans really got mixed up in all this 2 centuries ago. Juvenile elephants, they're smaller, they're easier to feed and transport and water, and they're very trainable. If they haven't spent enough time with adult elephants, they don't learn the need to fear humans or dislike them, so they can bond with a human being. And if there's one trainer there, there's a dedicated trainer who knows an elephant from a very, very young age, they will do all sorts of things for that person, and they develop a very strong relationship with that person. And that can go on for a while, but I know, especially for young males, by the time they hit their teen years, things start to get really difficult because they reach sexual maturity and they start to become really dangerous and unmanageable at particular times of the year. And the females, when they get into their 20s and 30s, they get sick of it. I don't know how
really?
To put it. You know, I mean, they're older. They've had a lot of experience and they know what's coming. And a lot of them are just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't know how a scientist would explain that, but this is the sense I got in my research, you know. And and if ever, I don't know if anyone's ever done this, maybe just me, but if you go to a zoo or someplace where they have an elephant show throughout the day and you watch the show throughout the day, if it's the same show, if it, you know, there's one at noon and one at 2 and 1 at 4, that kind of a thing, the first show, the elephants often will be very, very sharp and they'll follow their cues and do this, what they're supposed to do. The second show, they're a little bit more slow, and by the third show, they're just, like, ignoring commands and, you know, being really kind of recalcitrant. And I just, you know, whenever I've seen this, I thought, yeah, you know, they're just sick of this.
They're
bored.
They want
to go do their own thing. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about being happy, being bored. I mean, there is something about elephants. I actually watched a little bit of Dumbo in preparation for the show. There is something about elephants that just goes straight to the heart.
Yeah, they're so surreal looking, but somehow they're kind of cute. I can't quite figure that out myself either. And I think another reason that people find elephants really kind of sympathetic is the trunk. Because, you know, humans are fascinated by other animals that are also dexterous like we are. And I wonder if it's because our brains are wired to understand that way of being in the world, of picking things up and feeling things and touching things. And elephants have that. There's the trunk in particular, I think, has always been really fascinating to the public.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Yes, we are talking about elephants in this portion of Radio Times. Ringling Brothers announced that it was going to be phasing out its elephants at the circus over the next couple of years. And our guest is Susan Nance, wrote a book called Entertaining Elephants. Lines open to join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, talking about elephants. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Elephants have been a big draw under the big top in this country for a few hundred years. But come 2018, the greatest show on earth, Ringling Brothers, will be phasing out their elephant performers. And our guest is Susan Nance, wrote a book called Entertaining Elephants. She's associate professor in the Department of History and affiliated faculty with the Campbell Center for the Study of Animal Welfare. That's at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. And again, to join our conversation, we'd be curious about your response to what Ringling Brothers has decided to do. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Susan, it seems that Americans' interest in elephants goes back, what, almost about 200 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe 220, to be exact. The first elephant that we know of that came to the U.S. was a little 2-year-old juvenile who came from out of the port in Calcutta. And she arrived in 1795,
yeah.
And people people loved it. People loved seeing her. She was very endearing to people.
And who brought her over? How did she get over here?
Well, you know, in that period, the U.S. was one of the sort of growing maritime nation, and American traders on the high seas were famous for making a deal. And so there was many entrepreneurs in places like Boston who were just experimenting with importing all sorts of new products and commodities into the U.S. And so a lot of them would, you know, end up down in the southern part of the hemisphere over by southern part of the globe over by India. And so they would sort of, you know, bring back all sorts of things. And sometimes that meant live animals as well. So there was just a number of these sort of entrepreneurs who, the first one, his name was Crown and Shield, you know, and they brought juvenile elephants into the country to see who would buy one, and a lot of them made quite a bit of money.
And how did these little baby elephants, how did they fare in this country?
Not good.
I can't imagine.
I mean, I think, and the point wasn't really that they would fare well. This wasn't about establishing elephants in North America. I think, you know, in these days, the live animal trade across the Atlantic was, I mean, I always think of it as, you know, it was like displaying cut flowers. You know, you'd sort of get an animal in, keep the animal alive as long as possible, but there was no expectation of permanence. And so, the baby elephants that came in, they were often traded to, you know, handed off to people who didn't really have any experience with elephants. And they would drive them from town to town, and the elephants could sort of eat along the way. Mm. But they all died quite young. The first few died quite young, either from accidents or just mysterious illness. One of them was shot by a fellow in Maine because he was nervous about what this trade meant in terms of sort of the outside world getting into his small town. And but people did get better at it slowly. By the mid-19th century, elephants could manage to sort of live into teenagehood in the United States. But again, a lot of them died of just strange illnesses or it was strange to the people who had them, mysterious illnesses or accidents, drownings and things like that.
When did elephants become, you know, part of a big part of the big top?
Well, I think it's almost from the beginning because it was sort of in the 1850s when P.T. Barnum got into the circus business, and that was a big turning point. You know, he as you know, is one of the most famous sort of promoters and impresarios of the period and media personalities. And so he understood that people liked elephants and that they wanted bigger elephants, and he was always about, you know, bigger is better. So the circuses at that time in the industry, there had been sort of a shift whereby these sort of sole animal exhibitions or the sort of traveling menageries, sort of like a traveling zoo that had developed in the 1830s and 40s, they merged with the circuses such as they were at that point. And traditionally, the circuses were more of an equestrian circus or a human circus. And that's, if you go way back into history, into Asia and Europe, that's what circuses always were. So anyways, they merged with the menageries, and so companies like Barnum's would have, I mean, he very famously advertised that he had 10 elephants on his show, and this is in the 1850s and 1860s. And so a number of other impresarios started to do the same thing, and they were sort of a race to see who could have the biggest circus with the most elephants at the most expense and sort of flatter audiences with this idea that they deserved the most incredible, spectacular show. And things sort of escalated through the Gilded Age until the sort of beginning of the 20th century. And then there were so many other media that started to emerge, cinema, radio, eventually television, that the circuses had to sort of start scaling things down after that. But in the Gilded Age, they were the biggest entertainment companies people had ever seen. And so the elephant was a perfect icon for this because it's the largest animal most people had ever seen.
Well, and it seems that Barnum was very very savvy when it came to things like PR and used that to promote all these elephants and all the elephant acts, giving them names and genealogies and all of that.
He did, and actually he was just sort of elaborating on something that earlier showmen had sort of figured out in the 30s and 40s was that people wanted elephants that were public personalities in a way that they, you know, in a lot of the very, very early sort of menagerie, the trained animals, sort of traveling zoo advertising, you find, you know, the elephants are the only named personality on the advertising.
Interesting.
You know, or sometimes a really famous animal trainer or, you know, somebody who worked with the tigers and lions, you know, would also be named. But so they were there from the very beginning as public personalities. And the advertisers and the promoters and the, you know, the people who designed the chatter for the shows, they understood that there were certain kinds of information that people wanted about elephants. They wanted to know where they came from, how old they were, how big they were, how much they ate. And I think a lot of that information was interesting to people because people lived with horses, and they knew how much a horse ate, and so they could imagine, well, what would it be like to have an elephant? Especially kids probably found that really fascinating.
We talked earlier about the relationship between a trainer and an elephant, and obviously there are good and careful and even loving relationships, but there was the elephant hook and the use of pitchforks and it seems that the abuse of elephants is also part of this history.
Yeah, absolutely it is, and I think a lot of that is dependent on the sort of the time period in question and the person in question or people, group of people in question. It's sort of specific to a moment. In terms of the attitudes that people had, and some of it is a sort of chronic problem in the circuses. So in terms of, you know, the sort of specific case, I think elephant training has been a very male business for a long time, and I don't, by that I mean that it was always men that did it traditionally in the 19th century and even well into the 20th century. And circus people always said that the most terrifying guy on the grounds was the elephant man, because he often had a really intimidating persona, and he was really rough with his elephants, and his crew was rough with the elephants, and everybody knew that they were not to be messed with, these guys. And so there was a certain kind of machismo that went with being the elephant trainer, and I think often that expressed itself in trainers having a really sort of I'm the boss kind of attitude towards the training, that elephants were only safe and the public needed to, you know, understand this. They're not pets, and that they need to be afraid of their trainers or they will not obey and people are going to get hurt. And some trainers, even in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, were very open and vocal about the fact that they didn't like elephants, and they thought elephants were treacherous and wicked and needed to be punished, and would say this openly, you know, to a bunch of reporters from all the newspapers in New York City, and this would get printed verbatim in the New York Times or where have you.
Times have changed, hopefully.
Times have changed, yeah.
Yes.
And I think, so a lot of trainers would do a certain amount of really heavy-handed training in the early days when an elephant was quite young, in sort of more in the 20th century and later in the 20th century. And then if you got an elephant, if you had a really strong relationship with an elephant, you know, a trainer wouldn't need to be so harsh later. And I think a lot of that harsh treatment from the late 19th century was about, you know, one guy managing a crew of guys with a crew of elephants, and there's not a lot of chances for these sort of one-on-one relationships. But on the other hand, you know, when elephants reach adulthood, they, you know, all elephants are wired to sort of assert their independence because they're adults, and that's a normal part, you know, it's an evolutionary advantage we all have. And so that hasn't changed. And so the problem now, I think, that a lot of trainers have, even if they mean well and they do their best and they try to use positive reinforcement and these kinds of things, the fact remains that an elephant can overpower them. And there's quite a number of trainers who have said publicly that, you know, they were in denial for a while when their elephant got a certain age. They were in denial about how dangerous that he or she had become. And that people would tell them, you know, your elephant tried to hurt so-and-so the other day, and they'd say, no, that couldn't be true, you know, and they sort of had to come to terms with the fact that maybe they had reached their limits with the elephant.
Susan, let me reintroduce you. That's Susan Nance. We are talking about elephants because Ringling Brothers decided very recently, just last week, that they were going to phase out their elephant acts. They will be gone by 2018. And our guest Susan Nance wrote a book called Entertaining Elephants, Animal Agency and the Business of the American Circus. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Michael from Cape May Courthouse. Michael, go ahead. You're
Thank
on
you
Radio
much.
Times. Go ahead.
Very quickly.
Sure.
I think there are two other issues. One is the competition. I believe it started with Big Apple, and certainly Cirque du Soleil appealed to a cognoscenti that knew that there was enormous cruelty and abuse that went into these animals. And then the internet came, and you can see videos viral of the bullhook being used against these animals and just smashing them in the head. And then you see the elephant stepping on its trainer and squashing them to death. So, you know, I think either they think there's a morphogenic field of consciousness and these animals are becoming completely unmanageable, or more than likely, it's a tipping point. People have seen this virally, and the other circuses have cut into their profits.
Well, Michael, I appreciate that. Sure, and we're actually going to be talking about those human circuses in about 5 or 6 minutes or so. Susan, kind of picking up on what we've been talking about, the fact that you can see with your own eyes the potential mistreatment of an elephant, but also you can see an elephant using its incredible power to, in a sense, exert itself.
Yeah, this is absolutely the case, and it factors into, you know, what I was saying about how there's a new generation that is the audience for these circuses now, and that that generation, not only have they gone up with the wildlife documentaries and the protests at the circus, it's absolutely true, the caller said, they've grown up with the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, what the thing I found so interesting when I was doing my research is that, you know, the sources I had to deal with for the 19th century were all textual, maybe a little bit of graphic stuff in terms of, you know, drawings and the occasional photograph. And some of that stuff was pretty horrific. But it didn't affect me nearly as strongly as the stuff that you can find on YouTube now, where you see this and it's hard not to have an emotional reaction to it. So I think this is absolutely the case that audiences have more access to this kind of information. It's more graphic, and it's in a different context in which people tend to have more sympathy for elephants as intrinsically valuable beings.
Let me see what Christina from Los Angeles has to say. Hi, Christina. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
Just fine. Again, Christina from Animal Defenders International. Thank you for drawing attention to this issue. I appreciate all that has been said this morning, but I think it's really necessary to point out a few things, and that is that it's really a myth that these animals are treated or are trained through positive reinforcement. Unfortunately, our investigations around the world have shown pretty industry-wide abuse across species, and it's not just the elephants, and it's not just the adults, and it's fairly heartbreaking, as you might imagine. And when you add that to the impact of the severe confinement, the constant confinement, and the deprivation of all that is natural to them, you're really creating, as you've mentioned, a public safety issue.
Christina, let me just ask you a question. What is your organization?
Sure. Animal Defenders International
is
an international nonprofit, and we work to protect animals around the world, and we've worked particularly to the circus issue extensively. Here in Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, there have been several occurrences with elephants in its history, and we are working presently with Senator Leach, who announced just yesterday the introduction of a bill to ban the use of wild animals in circuses.
Well, you know, and Christina, I hate to do this to you only because we have just a couple of minutes with our guest, Susan Nance. I'm going to have to say goodbye to her. But let me give her a chance to respond to your comments. And I do appreciate the call to Radio Time. Susan, anything you want to say in response?
Well, I think Christina's absolutely right about the big organizations where there's people have big crews of elephants and big crews of people managing the elephants. You know, it's really, really difficult and expensive to get properly trained and dependable staff. And so there's an enormous amount of abuse that goes on just because people get frightened, they're rushed, they're exhausted, or they just have a bad attitude if the trainer sets the wrong tone. And I know that this has been a real problem in many places. It can also be true that if you have an individual trainer with an individual elephant, that they do form a relationship where the trainer doesn't have to be so harsh all the time.
Mm.
But generally speaking, Christine is absolutely right about the fact that elephants are I mean, deprivation is the word. They're just deprived of doing the things that they need to do to be, you know, elephants, to be normal and healthy. And this is an enormous strain on them. It's very hard work.
She mentioned Pennsylvania Senator Dalen Leach, and he did announce yesterday a bill to ban all animals in traveling circuses, saying that such exhibitions are inhumane for other animals as well. Susan, we've been talking mostly, strictly, really about elephants, and one wonders whether other animals in the circus are also going to get retired.
Yeah, I would suspect that, that will be the case. And, you know, I mean, I think, as the previous caller said, Cirque du Soleil and Big Apple Circus and these, you know, other companies are doing just fine with no animals or maybe just some horses or dogs. And, you know, maybe even that will pass in time. It's quite possible. And certainly in the case of any kind of exotic or wild animal, I think there's just no excuse anymore. You know, we know so much more about the dangers these animals pose, how the animals really suffer from what we ask them to do. I could see a bill like that. It might be difficult to pass, but I'm wondering if the industry, I mean, and in, you know, 100 years ago, circuses traveled with, you know, black bears and crews of tigers and lions and cougars and all sorts of animals that they don't use anymore because the public just doesn't want to see it, or it's too complicated or expensive, and it can be dangerous also. This is always, you know, also a workplace safety issue, and that's very important.
Well, on that note, Susan Nance, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's the author of a book called Entertaining Animals, Animal Agency and the Business of the American Circus. And we called her up to join us on Radio Times because last week Ringling Brothers announced that it will be phasing out its elephant performers over the next 3 years. And she's an associate professor in the Department of History, also an affiliated faculty with the Campbell Center for the Study of Animal Welfare at the University of Guelph, and that's in Ontario, Canada. And coming up, we have a guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about human circuses. They're here. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus announced last week that elephants would be retired from performing in 2018. We were just talking about the role that they have played in the circus, and now we want to discuss what's called the new circus. It features human feats and performances. Our guest is Duncan Wall. He taught acrobatics at the National Circus School of Montreal. He's creative director of Circus Now, author of a book called The Ordinary Acrobat, published back in 2013. And Duncan Wall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Seems like the new circus is really the old circus, yes?
The new circus is really the old circus.
It involves human beings and not animals.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's certainly the through lines between the old circus and the new circus are really strong. When we talk about new circus, just so the audience is aware, it's kind of a movement that began in the 70s, early 70s, away from the kind of bigger three-ring circuses to more intimate circuses that often featured, like you're saying, human performances, that featured things like storytelling, theatrical techniques, dance, often had a kind of meaning to the shows, and that movement has sort of grown up in the last 40 years. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the industry about whether, you know, the new circus is the same as the old circus, right? And you know, I tend to think there's, like you're saying, a huge through line, but there's some debate about that.
Well, and I'm thinking of, you know, the Pickle Family Circus, Big Apple. Those are examples of the kind of new circus that's oftentimes comes to town.
Yeah, so there are. It's really like a spectrum, you know, like in the same way that with film, for instance, you might have your sort of indie movies, right, that are kind of dark and difficult and more risque, or European movies, and then your big Hollywood blockbusters. In the circus world, you have that same kind of scale.
Right.
Some of them are sort of like what they call traditional, right? So your Ringling Brothers circuses, or the old big circuses that we think of, Cole Brothers. Then there's things in the middle that are kind of like the neoclassical circuses. So Big Apple would count as a neoclassical circus. because it still has a ring. You know, you still have the codes of the circus, the ringmaster, the kind of classical circus band, acts that last 6 or 7 minutes. Same thing with Pickle Family Circus. You have stuff like Cirque du Soleil, which again is kind of in there too, kind of in the middle. It's identifiably a circus. And then you got the stuff that's actually more progressive and more avant-garde. That's really all about physical performance and really has done away with a lot of the codes of the circus.
And what was your introduction to this kind of circus?
So I got plunged in to the newest of the new. I was in France, where there's a lot of progressive, interesting avant-garde circus theater. And I was studying abroad there in college and happened to see a show, and it just took us to a show, and it blew me away. It was this weird mix of kind of dance, physical theater, guys in black suits, kicking walls, screaming, singing, but also doing these amazing backflips. It was this kind of total form of theater that intrigued me. So I went back on a Fulbright Fellowship to study at the National Circus School of France, and then, you know, kind of dive into that whole movement over there and figure out what was going on and why it wasn't in America as fully.
And why wasn't it in America as fully?
I mean, it's a complicated question. There's a lot of factors. One is relates to the way we support the arts in America. In a lot of the countries where the circus took off, it was the government that came in and really subsidized it in the beginning, especially in the 70s. They set up national circus schools, such as they have in France or up in Canada or Belgium or even Sweden now. They subsidize companies. So basically, you know, if you think of it almost like as a kind of R&D project, right? The circus had its kind of codes, and it was relying on those codes really heavily. And what it needed was this injection of money to do a lot of research, as it was called, or kind of create new creative work. And in Europe, the government provided that money. And so you had the birth of all these new different companies exploring circus. So saying, well, what happens if we make a circus show of, like, just a juggler? Right? The whole show is just juggling. Or what happens if we, you know, build a circus show around something like light and sound, and as in use the physicality in that light and sound, as opposed to, you know, thinking of it as a structured series of acts. So in the States, we didn't have that, so that was kind of an issue. Right. We don't have that same kind of artistic support. And then also it's related to our tradition. Like, we have a really definitive idea of what the circus is in America based on how popular it was for 150 years, according to those codes. And so it's been, to some extent, hard for Americans to kind of let go of that and think of circus as something bigger or different or kind of more outside the box. Although, of course, Cirque du Soleil has helped a lot.
I was just going to ask you about Cirque du Soleil, which I have seen. And, I mean, just absolutely extraordinary performances and quite a spectacle. But it sounds like you're talking about some of the more sort of avant-garde uses of dance, perhaps, and puppetry and gymnastics and theater and all the sort of physical things that go into performing as part of a circus.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, and it's this fascinating question, or at least I'm personally fascinated by it, and I think that a lot of the field is fascinated by it today. It's like, what is circus?
Yeah.
You know, like, if you were to try to define circus, like, what does that even mean? And, you know, if you take away a ring, is it still the circus? If you take away, obviously, animals, if you take away even, like, a ringmaster or the codes or all of it, you strip it back to its kind of essential nature, what is it, right? And there are a lot of folks who think that a circus is, by definition, just a kind of assembly of wonderful or extraordinary or interesting things. And by that definition, you know, you could really get out there. I mean, there are circuses that I've seen that have, like, very little physicality, right? It's just kind of things that make you go, wow.
Such as?
Well, I mean, you know, and here again, it kind of is an interesting question of, like, is this new or is this old, right? Like, because when you look at the old circuses, they had things like opera singers and pickpockets in them. They had puppeteers and performers like that. They had actors. And so I've seen circuses in Europe that have, you know, you won't have an acrobat per se, but you'll have a kind of object manipulator. So somebody moving even, like, plastic bags around in a way that's kind of fascinating. And then, like, a really, really tall person will walk out and do a weird step dance or something. Like, what is going on? But what unifies them all is that sense of, you know, you just couldn't see them anyplace else. And so you're confronted with that. The other thing I would say, too, just to add to that, to not give a total false impression, is that, you know, there is this notion, too, of skill in the circus, right? Like, things can be extraordinary because they're weird or because you've just never seen them before. Or they can be extraordinary because they're really skillful, you know, and that's a lot of what the circus is this human beings who have sort of worked themselves up and develop themselves in such a way that they can do something that's skillful that impresses us.
Do you think we need a new word? I mean, the circus sort of so embedded in, certainly in this country, the sort of Ringling Brothers version of circus?
That's a funny question. Yeah, I mean, it's personally, I think no. I think that's kind of just our job as a field, and as you know, in the same way that dance used to mean ballet or used to mean a certain kind of codified forms, now it includes, you know, rolling on the ground, and it includes throwing yourself up in the air against a wall or any kind of physical movement. I think circus actually can have a bigger definition. It's just that folks need to own that word. The new and the old need to kind of own that word in a way that's bigger and broader and be more inclusive with it. One of the interesting things you actually saw, and it's kind of fading now, it doesn't happen as much, but from the last kind of 15 years, is people would, or companies and artists would identify themselves as Cirque. Right?
Yes.
They would take the circus word, the French circus word, which Cirque just means circus in French, and they would say, oh, we're doing Cirque. And the implication was we're doing circus, but it's not the same as the kind of circus you know of. Now you're seeing less of that because the word circus is coming to be understood more widely. But it was sort of a funny thing for somebody who, you know, speaks French too, where it's like, well, you're just saying your circus. So, you know,
let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Duncan Wall, and he's the creative director of Circus Now. Wrote a memoir back in 2013 called The Ordinary Acrobat. He did teach acrobatics at the National Circus School of Montreal, and we've been talking about the new old circuses that do not involve animals. They do involve humans doing extraordinary things. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Duncan, I wonder whether fringe festivals are a good place for what we have been talking about, where the kind of performance that you're talking about fits kind of nicely in a fringe festival.
Yeah, some of that. I mean, you know, I think the thing that kind of it's sometimes difficult for people to get over or in their heads is that the idea of the circus as just like a separate form of performing arts. You know, you have dance, you have theater, and you have circus. So really anywhere that you would see a dance show or a theater show, you could also see a circus show. We just did Circus Now, the organization that I help organize. We supported a festival that was done in New York this year called Circus Now, International Contemporary Circus Exposure, which was 9 companies from around the world all doing this kind of new circus. And that was on a stage. You know, it was in the middle of Manhattan. It was at Skirball Center. And I think before we did our festival, there was like a, I don't know, some kind of like music group from Thailand or something. And afterwards, there was a dance show. You know, and that's a lot of what we're doing, too, is trying to initiate those conversations with theaters and with presenters, you know, people who present work around this kind of new form of circus, because, you know, our feeling and what we've kind of observed is that audiences tend to really respond to it because it has the qualities of dance and theater that people like, the kind of progressive, interesting, meaning-based, but also has a popular, spectacular component. I mean, anybody can go to a new circus, even if it's, you know, you might not be into modern dance, but you can go to a modern circus because there's always that wow factor.
It's funny you just said that because I just scribbled the word wow. I mean, that's part of the importance of part of that circus experience is to go, oh my goodness gracious.
Yeah, it's kind of like what I was saying earlier, and this is why a lot of folks define circus the way they do, is because, you know, you can walk in and it makes you see something out of the everyday. And I think one of the big questions that the circus industry and the artists specifically are asking themselves is like, what do you do with that? You know, is it just enough to show somebody something that makes them say, wow, or, you know, is something that they haven't seen before? Or do you actually want to take that skill, take that wow, and actually apply it to, you know, conveying some kind of meaning or message or telling a story? And there are a lot of artists who feel that is important.
So were you an ordinary acrobat? And by that, I guess,
maybe, you
know, not, like pretty good.
I was bad.
You were actually bad.
I think it was, the title, it was sort of about, you know, this idea that I was just a kind of a regular guy who ended up going to circus school in France and exploring the world. And I'm now, you know, deeply embedded in the world. And I feel like my regular guy-ness is actually quite normal for circus today. You know, one of the things we've seen in the circus world is there's been this kind of shifting notion of the kind of performance that gets done, but also a big shifting notion of who can participate in the circus. And since the 70s, there have been this huge rise of circus participation, circus schools, circus clubs, all over the world. Just one little stat would be that in Europe today, there are over a million circus youth alone performing circus or studying circus.
Really?
In the States, we have hundreds and hundreds of schools. In New York, there are dozens alone, New York Lyme-based. And so it's kind of become this idea that circus isn't just for, you know, those families. It's for everybody. It's a mix of theater and sport. It's creative. It's physical. And it's, you know, a great way to live, too.
Are you a good juggler? Can you juggle?
Again, when you get in my line of work, you're really reticent to say you're good at anything because there are people who are crazy good.
Yeah, I hear you.
I can do five balls, you know, kind of badly. I can do, you know, if I'm focused, and I can do some tricks with three and four, so I can get by.
Yeah,
it's, you know, if I'm with my non-circus friends, they're impressed, and with my circus friends, they're like, yeah, okay.
roll their eyes, right? But you've taught this stuff,
right?
Yeah, go
back to the theory.
You've taught.
Well, I taught. Yeah, I'm sorry. I taught at the circus school in Montreal. I taught history and aesthetics, so kind of how to think about the circus and how to explore the circus creatively. And I've done some juggling workshops and little clowning workshops and performed as a clown. But I'm by no means a kind of expert in those fields.
You know what? Whoa! I'm afraid. I hope we're not losing your phone line there. But are you still there, Duncan?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear
okay.
Me?
Yeah, there was just kind of a scrambly sound on the phone there. But you know, I think of a lot of circuses involve circus families. I mean, it becomes part of a tradition, almost a dynasty. I think in some cases where things are handed down. Are we seeing that in the kind of circuses that you and I are talking about?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, you're certainly not seeing it in the way that you did before, insofar as the knowledge was almost like proprietary, you know, like a given family would have a given set of skills and they would pass those skills directly down to their kids to the exclusion of the outside world. What you are seeing, though, is at least I feel like, you know, a lot of people that I've observed who are in the circus or are associated with the circus, like maybe they run a school or maybe they run a camp. It's just hard for their kids not to get drawn in a little bit. You know what I mean? Like when your parents are kind of playing in this physical way that's open and expressive and seems a lot of fun, you know, it's natural that as a kid, I think you'd start to want to do that. And as a parent, I think it's natural then that you would want to engage your child in that activity, which is something that we're starting to see emerge too in the States, or what are called community circuses, where it's literally, you know, people from the community coming together and doing circus together, just doing, you know, learning to juggle together, doing basic acrobatics, but doing it as a family activity. Because it turns out it's a great way to bond as well.
Well, I mean, it sounds like things are good when it comes to the kind of or getting better when it comes to the kind of circuses we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's exploding. I mean, it's America, all over the world. There are national circus schools emerging every year. There are studies emerging now that are showing how circus affects well-being and self-esteem, how it's good for kids, good for adults. There's actually a study going on in Canada right now about the cognitive developments of circus and showing that doing circus, because it's non-competitive but also physical and creative, has interesting effects on the brain and on youth development and youth empowerment. So yeah, I mean, we're really hopeful, and you know, like we say, is that it's not so much a family activity anymore, but we're kind of a big family now. And so, you know, with Circus Now, the organization that I help run, it's kind of, we'd like to be inclusive of anybody who's interested in the circus at all. So I just say to your listeners, if you are even curious about the circus, or even, you know, think you might want to do the circus, you absolutely can. And we're happy to help you find a place to do that.
And Duncan, well, on that note, my thanks for joining us today on Radio Times, Creative Director of Circus Now. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. That was close. I'm Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Help this week from Quinn Libson. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.